start? Shall we start? It's all live. Good. Goedemiddag. Yeah. Ik ben Clemens en ik werk bij Microsoft in Redmond in de Windows Azure Fabric Group. And that's about as much as I can say in Dutch. Yesterday, we took a taxi with a few friends and went to town. And we got into that taxi. The taxi driver completely misunderstood the directions. And the guy who was sitting in front only spoke English to the taxi driver, who didn't speak any English. And so realizing the seriousness of the situation, I then remembered, well, you just grew up right by the border, so you might be able to help. So I actually talked for the first time, and I don't know, 20 years Dutch with the driver, and he understood everything that I said to him, and I was very, very surprised. So I grew up right by the border. I was actually at a game on Saturday. It's not looking like we're going to stay in the league, though, with Borussia Mönchengladbach. But we'll see how that all works out. So, up to this point, we can cut all this out of the video. So, this session is about Windows Azure App Fabric and all the things that we have done in Redmond and are currently doing, that we have done since January 2010 when we released the first set of services, Service Bus and Access Control. I'm going to be talking about those services, and I'm going to be talking about the service that's going to be released to commercial availability later today, as far as I know, or tomorrow, the cache service. And I'm also going to talk about a service that's currently called Composite App Service or Container, but that in reality is something that's a hosting service for which we don't have a name yet, but I'm going to show you a little bit about that, and you're going to see and hear more about this as the year progresses, because this year is the year when we're going to go and make that available in CTP form for you to try out. So PowerPoint is a wonderful app. Server apps are wonderful, and they're really easy. And if you go and look at all the folks who are talking about web apps, they say, hey, it's all simple. If a browser, you have a middle tier, in the middle tier is always the web server, and you run it in PHP and Ruby, and then you have a database behind. The database is either SQL for us old people, and for all the young people, it's NoSQL, and that makes up the entirety of your application. Thank you, you're done. And scaling is really easy. You have many browsers. You have many servers. It's all simple. Sometimes you need to go and share a little bit of state. You have some session state facility. You're done. Architecture, perfect. Unless you have things that are a little more complicated. So when we go and then drill into things that are happening, and you know all this, there's always more to building an app like that. Let's add a few clients. So in addition to browsers, we now have apps. And apps are a little different in that they need different kinds of backing from the server. It's not web, it's not UI that's being served up, but it's data that's being served up. It's also data that's being served up for all kinds of different devices in different forms. So you need to people are building today fairly sophisticated REST services. Glenn Block is talking about how to build sophisticated REST services. Parallel to this session, you'll have to see that on video. And so if you go and scale those, you have backing services, and those backing services also need to be scaled out. Those services, or generally services, that are the backbone of an app tend to have more state than the UI has. So there's longer running processes that need to be managed. They tend to be more stateful. And so you need to have that state somewhere managed. If you have a back-end process, and that's a business process, and that business process needs to run for 3 days supervising things that are going on, that thing has state. And you can't make that stateless. Stateless is an illusion, and everything is stateless as long as it runs, right? And so in web apps, the time where something accumulates state is just very short, and it tends to be that in middle-tier services and back-end services, that period of time is somewhat longer, and for that you need to have support. So you need to have ways to go and take take ephemeral state of a service and then just put that somewhere. And as soon as that service gets reactivated again, you need to get that state back. You need to get that state also replicated across a bunch of systems. So it gets fairly complicated very quickly. Then you need to have authorization and authentication on those services. And today it comes more and more out of fashion to have your own user database with your username and password, because users hate it. I hate it to have the same username and password everywhere, because it's just impossible to remember them all. So we want to have smaller number of identity providers that we can deal with, and they need to be integrated into applications, but that integration also takes a lot of work. Then when I talk about apps, those apps are not always online. The wireless network here is a good example of that, you might be connected if you're lucky, and then again, you're not connected. We'll see how that wireless network works out for me, by the way. I just noticed I haven't taken care of the network. We'll see. Once I get to the demos, I will either horribly fail or cry for help. So that app will want to talk to a backend service, irrespective of whether that backend service is reachable or not. Or sometimes the backend service wants to tell that app something, but the app might not be connected. How do you get that data back? How do you create connectivity between an app and the backing service when the network is flaky? So that's a hard job. If the app is a desktop application or some server application, how do you create connectivity if that app lives somewhere in a network that you can reach? Similar problems about decoupling also between the front end that is the web server and the back end that is the services layer. If you want to go and decouple those things, if you have a web tier that gets very spiky traffic, and you have a middle tier that needs to do business processing, and how do you take that spiky traffic and make that flat so that you don't overstress the middle tier? Well, the easy thing to do here is to put a queue in the middle, or to put a more sophisticated PubSub infrastructure in the middle, but you need to have one. Then in your middle tier, the middle tier will have to talk to, in most cases, to some other line of business apps, to a CRM app, to an ERP app, to an HR app, to whatever the apps are, so you need to have integration. I'm going to have in my Service Bus talk tomorrow a nice picture about this, where we've been talking about integration for the longest time, integrating apps, web services calls between apps, and now imagine you have one app that you want to go and move up to the cloud. What that means is you have this one app and that's talking to five different apps, and now you want to move that up. That app still needs to be able to talk to those services even though they are inside the firewall, inside the corporate firewall. So you need to have a communication link between the cloud and on-premise, also into the firewall without opening up the floodgates for external traffic. And VPNs are not necessarily the solution for that. I'm going to be talking about that in detail in the Service Bus session tomorrow. I'll be talking about Service Bus here too, no worries. And then if the data gets larger, you need to deal with partitioning and with aggregation of data from multiple sources. And of course, with caching, holding onto reference data, so you don't have to do database round trips all the time. So that seemingly simple three-tier app turns into something that's rather complicated very quickly. Add to that the cloud. So the cloud is interesting. So we're currently building apps on-premise, and they have all these challenges. The cloud adds specific challenges or opportunities, because there's money to be made if you build your apps in a certain way. So I'll try to illustrate that with a few pictures, which are not very technical, and they're probably also not very wise from a business perspective, but we'll see. So when you build box software, so we talk about appliance, box, and cloud. So box is the server. software you go and install at a customer site. Classic ISV model. So the customer in that model has three elements of cost to think about. The first one is infrastructure investments. They need to buy servers and cooling and server basic base software, and they need to buy all this. They also need to have people on staff or as consultants which deal with all that equipment. They also go and buy the software. They have an ISV software license that they need to go and buy, and that's their upfront cost. So if you want to go and sell a customer software, they are facing a steep initial investment to go and get that software. So cloud software is really interesting for them because it's a low-risk option. It's not only about the prices of software, it's also about the price of the infrastructure investment that is there. In addition to that, the customer has recurring costs to operate all this machinery, but then also the ISV is interested in a steady income stream. So what we tend to do in the industry is we tend to charge a little bit up front and then recurring monthly maintenance fees from the customers. The way how we widen our margin in that business is the income scales with the customers, is obvious, and then the margin widens as the R&D cost gets distributed across all these customers. So the more customers you have, the more commonality you have across them, the lower your cost gets per customer, the wider your margin gets. So that's the basic ISV business model for server. The same thing applies to cloud because you still have the same picture in terms of widening your margin as you can spread R&D costs across a broader number of customers, but something else happens too. So that's the margin you have here. Something else happens too. First of all, the infrastructure investment for the customer disappears. With that, very often, the initial license fee also disappears. With that, the customer has no more upfront costs. So that's a really good thing for the customer in terms of opting into cloud computing. Software as a service is a great business because you lower the bar for the customer to come to your solution. It costs them nothing in upfront investment except, you know, taking a bet on your platform and basically showing up with people. But really, in terms of infrastructure investment, it's cost them nothing. Now, for the ISV, for us as software developers, there's something else that's happening, and that's a really interesting economical piece, and that doesn't exist in the box. The maintenance fee turns into something that I would call the service operation fee. That's what you pay us to run the service for you, right? You pay Windows Azure for compute, and that's really what you pay for us running the service for you, and we just have meters how to do this. So this is service operation cost. For SaaS, you have a model which fits the needs of whatever app you build. So you have a per seat charge or whatever you're building. And that's a service operation fee. Now, the interesting thing here is this ISV has service operation cost. So you're providing an app that you build, and it's, let's say you charge just a number, $50 per month per user. That translates, and that's typically some complex calculation, to some usage of compute and storage, et cetera, on the cloud platform. What you will do initially, you will charge X amount of margin on top of this, and that's kind of where that's where your happiness comes from. The goal needs to be that you can drive that down too. So as you lower your operation cost, your margin widens there too. Now, how do you get there? You need deployment automation. You need self-healing architectures, you need auto-scale, you need high density, you need multi-tenancy. Multi-tenancy, let me explain all those terms. Multi-tenancy means, and this is something we practice in Windows Azure, and you can look at the platform and see it. What that means is we have a pool of machines, And we run all the services for all the users co-located on those machines. There's two schools, and one is take the existing on-prem software and just install it in the cloud. So a customer comes on, and you go and deploy machines for them using the existing software that you have, single-tenant software. Or you re-architect your app in a way that it is multi-tenant, that it actually can deal with multiple tenants at the same time, so that you can run the work for this for multiple separate tenants, separate organizations, on the same infrastructure. We call this high density. The higher the density is, the more you can co-locate services onto the same kind of resources, the more you can max them out, the lower is your operation cost. What's interesting here is that now, with this cloud computing thing, with multi-tenancy, and also with a quest to get higher density into those machines, optimization pays off because you're running those systems as a SaaS provider, if you are a SaaS provider, which means you can keep the service fees flat or even go down over time as you keep optimizing the system, but you can still widen your margin. So that's a really interesting thing. So what we recognize, though, on all these pieces is it's really, really, really hard to get there. And when I say self-healing architecture, what could I possibly mean with that? We have a piece in the system for Windows Azure App Fabric for how your credit card, right, when you go and purchase a subscription or you get the trial subscription, when you have a subscription, that subscription lands in the three services. So it goes to Windows Azure, it goes to SQL Azure, it goes to us, to Windows Azure App Fabric. So now that subscription needs to be turned into records in our database. And then as you come to our portal and you register a new namespace, that new namespace then also needs to be created. So we call this is an enterprise app which is hidden inside the system. You never see it. It's called the provisioning system. And that provisioning system was built at a time when Windows Azure was very, very nervous. In the early stages of beta, the table store would show up and go away. The queues would produce dupes. So really early. So we had to build something that would stand up and be enterprise resilient in the face of constant failure. And the system acts to the ops people as if it was under constant panic. So it throws, of course, errors because we had to do that. But it is architected to heal itself. So all the jobs are logged and they are equipped with timeouts and the system knows when something is inconsistent. So we had to do quite a bit of extra work. But the architecture heals itself. So we have, since we went into the first CTPs back in 2009 with that system, it's 2008, we have not lost a single job. And they strand. They sit there, and it happens, and the system fails right in the middle of it. And there's a gate at 15 minutes, there's a gate at 4 hours, and there's a gate at 8 hours, and there's basically just the jobs pile up, and there's more and more discovery that the system does after these times to go and find stranded stuff. So it just does forensics on stranded orphan data that it does and cobbles them all back together. But so that's all investment that we made, and that's kind of knowledge that we acquired. So our goal is, over time, that we can give that to you. We can give that to you in guidance, and we can give that to you in software. And the guidance specifically, the software that we're building, is App Fabric. So we know that we need to go and integrate with systems. We need to scale systems. We need to upgrade systems. We have had zero downtime in Service Bus since we shipped. And we have rolled the service at least a dozen times. Rolling means we have taken the bits, replaced entire bits, and rolled out the new system without a single moment of downtime. That's all knowledge that we acquire, and that's knowledge we want to give to you. But for that, we need software, and we're building that. So the multi-tenancy aspect, let's get back to that business, to the business piece. The multi-tenancy aspect is something that's really important. Multi-user access control, multi-tenant, you need to have multi-tenancy built into the frameworks, and multiple application hosting so that you can not only deploy a VM as you currently do in Windows Azure, a role as a part of an app equates a VM. That's not high enough density. What we want is you can have a, there's a bunch of VMs and you give us an app, and that app, we just put that onto VMs as there is load and you pay less in compute. So we want to be go sub VM and want to give you, we decide for you because we know the system better, where the application on which VM that runs, and if the app doesn't need any resources right now, it's not costing anything. So that's a goal, that additional complexity of multi-tenancy and high density and all those things is being dealt with. So building all that yourself is not so easy, so there's middleware. So let's go and take a look at the middlewares that you typically have. There's certainly web services, web service infrastructure. There's numerous ones. There's several service bus infrastructures you can use, stuff to get infrastructures to get data from A to B. There's numerous message queuing systems and PubSub systems you can leverage. There's multiple caching systems that are available. There's multiple workflow or stateful component infrastructures you can leverage. Access control systems, routing, messages, transformation, integration things. It's all middleware pieces that exist in .NET, that exist in the .NET community and also exist partially for Microsoft. And that you can use for those things. It looks a little, the landscape is a little lighter when it comes to easy deployment of applications. For deployment of applications in the style that we do it in inside of Microsoft for our services, that landscape is very thin. So, for instance, for us to roll out a scale unit for a service bus, which is a scale unit is kind of a one stamp of machines that on which we locate a few thousand accounts. That's a group of 150 machines, 150 VMs, just about. We can make those a little bigger, we can make those a little smaller, but like the average size is 150 machines. And they have different roles. So they take on the role of being a service bus protocol front-end node and a coordination nodes, there are all different kinds of roles. To roll this thing out onto the 150 machines to get them from basically a dark void to an operating thing and to check out the system, that's a single line of PowerShell code. I mean, it's one command. And then the provisioning system just goes out and provisions all the machines, sets up all the DNS records, interconnects them all, rolls out all the config and does all those things. That's hard. That's really a lot of work. We built a half a year on that deployment system, and that was the first run. And now we gained all that knowledge and want to go and formalize that in the software. So that's hard. But then if you pick on top of that your own infrastructures, every single one of them has other ways of configuring and then also of scaling them. So you have caches, and with caches you need to build certain kinds of clusters. With a web service infrastructure, with a bus infrastructure, you also need to build a different kind of kind of cluster. So you need to do that for the all individual infrastructures. All of them have different management hooks, and all of them have different programming models and tools. So the goal that we have here very clearly is to make your lives easier by integrating all those pieces. So to have a single programming model, or at least a consistent programming model, and to have a single tooling experience that's integrated, to have a single set of services with joined common management, so have a common way and one way to go and manage services for an application, a common way of doing scaling, and have all that work on the appliance, on the box, and on the cloud. So the clear goal here is to have full symmetry between the cloud and on server and in the appliance. So today, you see us doing most of those things, and this is why this is called Windows Azure App Fabric, in the cloud first. and not yet on server. There's a product called Windows Server App Fabric, and if you take a look at the cache will actually show you what the direction is, because the cache API is identical with the on-premise API. So that's where that's all going. So we start with the cloud. The reason why we start with the cloud is a basic distributed systems wisdom. And that is, if you start with something that's built for local, you can't make it work distributed. The same applies to the cloud, as we learn. If you make something that's distributed and you want to run it as super high scale, that's also not going to work. So what that means is, you build something that's for a dozen machines, that's not going to work for 120 machines, or 1,200 or 12,000. So we need to build for high scale first, and then we need to go and scale it down, because it doesn't work the other way around. So that's what we're doing. We're building cloud first. Our entire team is doing cloud right now. And as the year progresses, we're going to start working on the first version of what we're doing for server by scaling the system down, literally. So we'll have integration with Visual Studio. We're going to have a set of tools around that. We're going to have a management experience around this, which I'm going to show. And we'll have a hosting platform that you can run things on. And then we have all these additional services that sit on that same hosting platform that you can also be able to put your services into. So, the network issue is going to haunt me, I'm sure. So how do you go and scale your application to deal with higher load when you need more perf, you need to have more throughput? One of the ways you do that is you add a cache, right? So caching is one of those things which you start adding to an application once you get to the stage of where you want to optimize that. Typically, a very good idea, once you do some data triage and you figure out what your read-only data is and what your read-write data is, and what is the data that's requested most often, and where can you relieve the database of pressure. There's tons of data that's easily cacheable that you show on pages all the time that needs to be semi-accurate, but that can be easily cached. If you want to keep that in memory, and if you want to keep that coordinated in memory across multiple services, then that's typically something you can do with very well with a cache. So we have a service that's called the Windows Azure App Fabric Cache Service, and that will be commercially available later today, as far as I know. I haven't heard anything to the contrary. So there will be a press release out of Redmond today, I would be guessing, and where they will reveal all the data. I can't do that just yet, but that will happen. And so the cache service will be commercially available today. And I'm going to tell you what that does. So it's a distributed in-memory cache built on the same caching infrastructure, the same caching model and programming model that you know already from Windows Server App Fabric Cache. This is the thing that was codenamed Velocity. And so that cache is a multi-tier and two-tier cache, which has a central cache server. And so that's a cache infrastructure that we operate in the data center. And as a client, which has a local client cache. So it's a write-through, it's a local cache that you can add as an option. What that thing gives you is very fast lookup speed, obviously, on the local machine, leveraging the local memory. And then a centralized cache where you can share state in a quicker way than you can do on the storage. Now, just to be clear, that service is really good for data that is expensive to acquire, that it can easily serialize, that you can put in the database. But it's not this is not the place where you store all your data. It's really an optimization mechanism, and as it is an optimization mechanism in every web page, it's an optimization mechanism also here. What it has, it's a cache-aside model, generally. So It's not a write-through magic cache where you put that on the path to your database and it remembers things automatically. It's a simple key-value store, so you do a lookup on the key-value store. If you find your data there, you take it. Otherwise, you go into whatever your branch you do to do your data acquisition, you get your objects, and you can store them inside of there. The objects you can store is anything that's .NET and that's serializable. If you have the local cache option turned on, that object doesn't even get serialized. It basically just counts the footprint and holds onto that object, and you can tell how many objects can be held, and they don't get even serialized. They get serialized as they get stored in the central cache. So the local cache is a write-through cache kind of thing if you go and enable it, but it can hold a local object, and it then reacts to memory pressure and to eviction policies, etc., as you have that sitting in the local cache. The capacity, what's available is sizes 128 megs, 256, and doubles up to 4 gigabytes. That doesn't seem to be a lot because, you know, I can have a memory stick, and that memory stick has 4 gigs or 16 meanwhile. But remember, you can store a lot of data in 4 gigabytes, and that was a lot of data until not so recently. So that's the sizes that you get. And you can go and have multiple caches, and you can all group them together to form a single cache. So it auto-partitions across multiple caches, but you can't grow a cache above 4 gigabytes. You can change the size. So once you've provisioned and created a cache, you can go and change that size of the cache. You can shrink it and grow it. And if you shrink it, it will evict based on policy. If you grow it, it will also keep your data. So it's not going to set up a new cache and erase it, but it's actually going to go and preserve your data in there. So that's the cache. So let me just go and take a look at what the connection does here to the network, because otherwise it's not going to be fun. That's what I was worried about. Is there no network cable? That's a good question. Because I haven't see there. I hadn't seen one. That was the problem. And then I didn't think of it because of the issues I had with the screen. All right, so let's see whether that works. There was a quick glitch. That looks good. I'm alive. I can continue with the session. It's amazing. Thank you. So that's what that screen resolution thing did to me. So let's go and look at the bottom here. So I'm using the Windows Azure App Fabric SDK, the latest version of it. The Windows Azure App Fabric SDK has the cache bits inside of it. The cache bits, the assembly, is actually an update to the one that we ship with the server. And the programming model is symmetric. It's effectively exactly the same thing. You have a data cache factory. In that data cache factory, you stick a configuration, and the configuration, we've folded this all out without the properties here, has first of all the security properties, where you have your authentication string. I have that stored up here in the app. And then here you can designate the servers, so you can have multiple server endpoints, and you just stash that into this as a collection. So it's taking all those servers as one client. Then timeouts, obviously. You have the maximum number of connections to the server. If you do a lot of concurrent requests to the client, as you have pressure from the top, you, of course, need to have multiple connections that are made to the cache service so you can deal with concurrent requests. So that's a tuning knob that you have. And then there's the local cache. When you want to enable this, says you can store 10,000 objects. They're going to live for, in this case, for 5 minutes, and they are invalidated by timeout. And that's the option that we have. So 5 minutes, after 5 minutes, they always go away. So you get to configure some of those settings, and you can go and get a cache reference, a cache client from that factory. And then it's really simple. You go and set the you add an object to the cache using a string, can be anything, and then you write that out. So if we go and run this, we land here. The client is already there. And I can add, I can write. Here's the output. So I got my object. So, I mean, this is as simple as it looks. And then we also have options with versioning. I'm not going to go into those in detail because you can just as well go and look at the documentation for the sophisticated options. It has built-in optimistic concurrency. So there's versioning built-in, which means you can use it as a database if you like to. It's a very fast one. If you just have transient state that you need to go and manage, then you can do that here too and manage that. So there's one quick example where you have two items. I'm getting the same item twice. I'm doing the update with the old version number, and here I'm doing the update again with the old version number, and that will, in fact, throw because now the version number that was remembered here, right, the second time you got that item, that is no longer valid because that update already happened. So this optimistic concurrency is built into the cache, so you can use it as a simple key-value store, really, to have coordinated updates from multiple places. So that's one thing you can do. The other thing you can do is in here, in an ASP.NET app, in ASP.NET, you can use the cache straight away as your session state provider and for page output caching. The way this is done is very simply, and here's what happens when middle-tier people write UI. So this is literally the sample from the cache. So you will now witness what happens when middle-tier people write web apps. There is no skill in the house. So, well, it's doing the simple thing. So, all I'm doing here, I'm doing nothing special, nothing tall, nothing great. I'm just adding stuff to the session. So let's go and, yeah, okay. So this is the default. So button gets clicked, and we're just stuffing the string into the session state and reading the session state on and projecting it out. Simplest possible app, and with an enormous amount of taste for the green background. So that's just using the session state facility of ASP.NET. That thing is now hooked up to a session state provider here that's the web, the distributed cache, session state, store provider. That's part of the assembly that we give you. And you can just hook that up into an ASP.NET app. Then down at the bottom here is the configuration of the data cache client, where you define what how the security is working and how you authenticate against that thing. And that's all the setup you need to do. And with that, you store your session state in the cache service. So it's config only. If you want to also store the output caching, you go and enable this. And then you have output caching enabled also using that same caching mechanism. So that's caching. Caching is fairly simple. I mean, the programming model is as simple as it gets. And we have the providers for session state, and we have the providers for the output caching. Whether or not you use this service will be a question of whether the performance gain you will get, and we're talking about, it's all about milliseconds, and about the number of requests you have, and about the pressure you have, whether the performance gain is worth the price. Right? So I invite you to watch for that Microsoft press release tonight, or find me tomorrow when I've read it, and then I'll be tomorrow at the Azure booth, and we can talk about that. So That was caching. Now, how do you do decoupling between subsystems? How do you balance work across workers? How do you distribute events to subscribers? There's all kinds of integration work or communication jobs that you need to do in an application, especially in a distributed cloud application, that needs extra infrastructure. In Windows Azure, we have a piece straight in Windows Azure called the Azure Table Store and Blob Store and the queue. And the queue in Windows Azure is a mechanism that is roughly equivalent, I would say, to mail slots and name pipes in Windows. So it's a basic IPC mechanism for how you can go from a web role to a worker role and shift jobs around. That's what it's for. There's a need for a higher, more sophisticated messaging infrastructure beyond that, which gives you full publish subscribe capabilities and gives you on the queue capabilities such as correlation that will allow you to build more sophisticated messaging applications and more sophisticated apps that scale through decoupling. So that's something that we provide with Service Bus. And we also, with Service Bus, provide the integration between on-prem systems and systems that sit in the cloud, or between different on-premise systems. So we have a number of customers who are using Service Bus as a cloud-based messaging infrastructure, completely independent of using it with Windows Azure. The cache really only makes sense inside of Windows Azure, at least the Azure cache, because the latency between your app and the cache must be minimal. Right? It doesn't make sense to host an application in the Netherlands and have a cache sitting in Dublin. Right? You have the data center here in Amsterdam, but even hosting an application on your own site and then going to the Amsterdam data center doesn't make a lot of sense. So Service Bus is different. Service Bus works and is useful for situations where you just need to go and connect to services, but you have network integration issues. So the Service Bus has been commercially available since January 2010. We actually shipped that version, the initial version, in November 2009 into the data center and then patched it up a little bit. Since then, we've done a wave of updates, and we're going to have the biggest updates since the release coming up with a new CTP that's coming up next month, and we expect that to ship in the second half of the year, and that will bring a number of new things. I will talk about them in more detail in the session tomorrow. I'm not just yet ready to show the API, mostly because we still have 4 weeks and we're still doing a little bit of polishing, and so that will be available at TechEd. But here's what this is for. I will show you. And it's best shown using a little demo, so I'm going to use a little demo here. So this is a simple app. It's a web service built with WCF. You have a web service host. Web service host gets opened. All the magic sits in the config. You have a service configured endpoint. So that's not surprising. The contract is an image contract using the WCF web program model, WebGet. The service implementation loads an image from a file, wraps it into memory stream, returns it, says, hey, that's an JPEG image, and returns it. So it's just a plain, simple service. So now I'm going to go and run that thing. So it's going to take a tiny little bit of time. The network is there, but the network is not fast. That much I can tell you. Yes, that's apparent. So here is well, that's great. If you're twittering on the network, go into your browser, hit that URI. So because that's what I'm going to do now. So you can go and copy this 2. So it's clemens-sandbox.servicebus.windows.net. Sorry that that's so long. /image/. So we go and take that. And oops, did I just close that? Yes, I'm an idiot. So I'm going to go into this browser window. I'm going to wait for it to show up again. I'm going to hit this. There it goes. Here we go. So that's the image. These are the founders of Microsoft. All of these are really, really, really rich people now. Just saying. Right? Don't diss the beards. They're all billionaires. So if you hit that URI, as long as that service runs, you will be able to hit that service. That service runs here on this network. I didn't do anything to that network. I have a public web service that I'm hosting on this stage. I'm doing that because of Service Bus and the capabilities that we have. If we can sniff the network with that client assembly, and sniffing the network means if we are able to see port 80 and port 443, so just HTTP, we can create a bidirectional channel into the client, and we can make you listen on the on Service Bus. So Service Bus is a cloud-based listener infrastructure for connectivity that allows you to take a normal WebCF service, and I'm going to leave that app running. So clemens-sandbox, you need to remember, servicebus.windows.net/image, because I'm not going to go away, but you can try. All right? So I'm going to leave that running. So let's go and take a look at the service once more and what I'm doing. What you'll notice is the binding here is a web HTTP relay binding. Usually, it would be the web HTTP binding. Right? That's the one that ships with WebCF. So we have made a web HTTP relay binding, which looks exactly like the one that you're used to. Also, NetTCP relay binding, WHTTP relay binding. So all these different bindings, and we have relay in the middle, but they are different because they're not listening on the local machine, but they're instead listening on the cloud. So you can take a normal service, and you can have that service effectively listen in the cloud infrastructure. We're also overlaying that with the access control service. So if I go, so whoever has hit this, I got to stop this again. So now it's easy for me to hit this, as you've seen. Then we're going to stop it. We're going to make a change in that I'm going to go and change the authentication type to relay access token. So the thing starts again. I hope I even compiled it. We shall see, I would think. Not getting anything. The reason why I'm not getting anything now, and that's the default, is we take the access control service that I'm going to talk about in a moment, and we overlay that over your endpoint. So now, with this switch enabled, you now need to bring a token, a security token, to be able to talk to this endpoint. And that token is set up in the configured in the access control service, how you can go and acquire that token. And integrating with the access control service enables quite a bit of magic, as I'll show you in a moment. So keep that in mind. So that was the basics of Service Bus. I'm going to go and dive deeper into all these things and exactly how that works tomorrow in my session that is at 10:50 in the Mississippi room. So what is new in Service Bus? Quick things. So these are all the things that we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about tomorrow in more detail with why, more detail about why you would use them. First of all, queues. So we're going to have queues and topics. Anybody who's familiar with message-oriented middleware TIBCO, MQ Series, and various other products will be familiar with the concept of topics. Topics is a publish-subscribe model, and queues. And we have a queue ourselves, MSMQ, the Microsoft Message Queue. It's a wonderful thing. It ships in every copy of Windows. If you don't use it in your apps, you should. We own that thing too. Right? So we're shipping a new next-generation queuing PubSub infrastructure. It is legitimately the successor of MSMQ, really, as a distributed systems infrastructure. And we're having topics in that as well. We have currently in Service Bus a message buffer. That's a small message buffer. And the characteristics of that are that it's an in-memory thing. It only lives for 10 minutes if you don't talk to it. If you talk to it, it extends its life into 10 minutes every time. Capacity of 2 megs and 60K in message size. That is now going to be changed, and this is coming with this CTP, to be backed by durable storage, SQL Azure, to have no limit in lifetime, which means you create a queue. That queue stays around forever. It's going to have a capacity that's still to be determined. We currently have a pre-version of this in the labs environment, and that's capped at 100 megabytes. We're looking into what we're going to do for the next CTP in terms of size. As we go into production, we certainly hope that we can go and up that into the gigabyte range. But we haven't landed on the exact number there. The message size is constrained to 256K for the queue and for the topic. For those of you who are building messaging systems, 256K doesn't sound like a lot, and I would tend to agree. So there's a feature called grouping or sessions, and what that allows you is to effectively create a convoy of messages, stamp them all with the same number, and if you have a competing consumer scenario, we have one queue and you have multiple parties pulling on that queue. As soon as a receiver pulls on the first message of a group, that group gets pinned to that receiver. So only that receiver gets those messages. So what you can do is you can take one message, chunk it up into chunks of 256K, and then disassemble and reassemble it. And we're looking into also providing that as overlaid magic, so you don't need to worry about this. But the foundational message size is going to be 256K. The topics, for those people who are not familiar with them, a queue is really a degenerated topic. What a topic is, it's a log of messages that's ordered by time into which one or multiple publishers can send messages, or in the picture from the bottom. Then you have N subscribers on that log. Every subscriber has an independent cursor on that log and can go and scroll down that log. It can never show up, in which case the messages are just held for it, or they're all showing up at various points in time. So as soon as a subscriber pulls on the subscription, the subscription walks up to the log, gets the next message, and then it can run a set of rules on that message. And only if that message matches the rule, you get that message out. So there's all kinds of things you can do with topics. You can do event distribution. You can do partitioning. You can do all kinds of interesting things with topics. And I'm going to go into the details of that in the next session because I still have two services to cover and time is getting close. But that's why I have this extra session on that as well. So that's tomorrow at 10:50 to talk more and more depth about Service Bus and all the capabilities in there. So next thing, and Vittorio Bertocci has a talk also here, and I don't have the time exactly, about the identity and access control in the cloud. And so this is the context of that. That's the access control service. And that's solving the problem of how do you secure the edge of your system with other identity provider. How do you leverage corporate Active Directory? How do you leverage Facebook, Google ID, Yahoo ID, Windows Live ID for your applications? Because that has been traditionally really difficult. Security experts like that stuff, and they love all their claims and protocols and all those things. It's just really, really difficult for everybody who has better things to do than reading protocol documentations for security. So how do you leverage all those things without having to learn all those different APIs? The goal of the access control service is to sit in the middle and just do all that work for you. So that is available. They have a V2 service that's just commercially released. I'm going to show that to you. And that is a revolutionary piece of software. We have the same name, but the team is actually sitting in Active Directory. And I have to say, that is as big for me personally as MTS Complus was for transactions. It is significant, and I'll show you why. So you have a website. The website has a relationship with the access control service. All that complicated protocol goop happens between the access control service and all these identity providers. So they support WS Trust, OAuth2, OAuthWrap, ADFS. They support Google and Facebook's proprietary protocol and Yahoo's protocols. OpenID, they do all these different protocols. And they have a fairly simple protocol that you can pick. And then you effectively get one token. You standardize on one. You can have a SWAT, as we call them, simple web token. Or you can have a SAML token. And that's the only thing you need to consume. And the great thing is that's all integrated with the Windows Identity Foundation that just makes that dead simple to do. So let's go and take a look at how that works. I have my production portal. That's the one. So here's the management portal for Windows Azure. In the production portal, you will find the access control service and service bus. I expect that by the end of the day today, at least Redmond time, we will see the caching node here. And so you have the access control service up here, and it's loading, and we're going into my current namespace. So notice all these here are all service bus namespaces, and they are pinned to ACS V1. And this is ACS V2. So ACS made a pretty dramatic step for a cloud service and went from effectively just being a supporting service for Service Bus to be an all-out, really useful, broad service. And they decided to break protocol. So they specifically broke the way how management works, because now the management system is really clean. It's all data-based. So we have now two versions of ACS. ACS V1, the existing one, only serves Service Bus, and Service Bus still depends on ACS V1, and will do so until we go commercial with the next version of Service, or with the next big update for Service Bus. So we're going CTP, around TechEd, with our preview for queues and topics, and then it takes us 3 months more to massage all this and make it all good. Once we go out with, and when I'm saying 3 months, I'm saying, you know, 3 software months. Right? They may be 35 days long or 45 days long, or they may be 28 days long. We'll see how long they are, but they're software months. So I didn't make a commitment here. Also for the people watching the video, especially in my own team. So as that happens, we're going to go and snap to ACS V2. So in the CTP, you will be able to use ACS V2. In production, you will have to wait another 4 to 5 software months until you can use ACS V2 with Service Bus. So that's my namespace. I'm going into the access control service here. In the interest of time, I'm going to walk you through the configuration that I already did. Or no, let's go and build one just because it's easy. So there's a number of identity providers you'll see: Facebook, Google, Windows Live ID, and Yahoo. We can look at the Facebook one. That's an application and an application secret that I have to change now because I have to showed it to you. So that's one of my apps. So this is how you set up a Facebook app. You create an app in Facebook, developer.facebook.com. You get an app ID and a secret. You put that app ID and the secret in here, and this is how you link those apps, that app as an identity provider into access control. Super simple, right? So that here corresponds to, what did I say? developer.facebook.com. There we go. Main toolpassingen. And the application we're looking at is Viola or Viola. I believe it's the second Viola or Viola. Yes, it is. So that's how, that's where you get the keys. You can go and set up those apps, and then you go and set put that data in here. It doesn't match because it's the second one. And that's how you set up identity provider identity providers. The other identity provider you can also set up is, for instance, and that's the big one, ADFS. So you can go and take any AWS Federation provider like ADFS and go and add that, and then have take the AWS Federation metadata, and there's guidelines for how to do this, for how to take your Active Directory, put Active Directory Federation services in front, and then basically just import the configuration, and that's how you federate with applications. I don't have that in that app here, but we can very easily do that with the Microsoft. You have to tell the Microsoft folks to give you the right metadata folks, so the MSIT folks, and they give that to us, and then we can very easily federate apps for this purpose. So relying party applications is where that comes into life. For relying party applications, it's best if we have one. So let's go and make one. So I'm going to make a new project. And MVC application 2 just seems fine. It's going to be an internet app. There's two or three things that I need to do that I always forget, at least two of. So we'll see how I do now. So this is a brand new MVC app that has forms authentication enabled. So what I'm going to do now is I have to bolt it down to a particular port because that needs to be predictable. So we go into properties, into web, and say we want to have a specific port here, and we're going to use port, let's say, 61,000. So that's why the application is going to be hosted as we just put it into the debugger here. And that is pretty much it, I believe. So let's go and run it. So we start a localhost application at 61,000. So there it is. And it has this logon capability up there. So this is forms authentication enabled. And assuming you have this built-in ASP.NET provider. So what we're going to do now is we're going to make that integrate with, let's say, Google and Facebook and all those things. So what you need to do is you go into the portal, into the relying party applications, you add one. And you say, this is my demo. I'm going to call this demo 4. I'm going to add this the settings manually. And I'm going to set the realm as, not this, as localhost 61,000. I'm going to set the, oops. I get lost. We set the return URL to 61,000, and I think that's mostly what I need to do. I can go and I can now pick a token format. SAML is just fine. I don't want to encrypt the tokens. The token lifetime for how long it's good is 10 minutes. That's fine as a default. And with that, I can go and just save the settings. I chose all identity providers. And now I'm going to go and into the rule group. What those rule groups do is the following. Every identity provider, as you acquire a token, has some information in that token, so-called claims. They say the email address, the name, and a personal identifier and all that data. So we need to go and map them from the original format to a canonical format or just pass them through. This is actually the way how the access control thing is done. What you do is effectively you set up a set of rules that say if if the input claim matches the following condition, then emit the following output claim. So the way how you grant access to a particular user is you make an if rule. If the email address equals this, then go and emit the following you can access the service kind of claim. So we're now doing that at this level. So I'm going to auto-generate all those rules based on those identity providers. So if I get Facebook, then I get the email address. From Google, I get the email address. So I'm getting the addresses from all those services. So that's all fine. Want that? So now I'm done with the configuration. I'm done with the configuration of the relying party, and I can go to the application integration page and just grab this federation metadata thing. And now I go back to Visual Studio and say that I please want to add the SES reference, the application URI is localhost 61,000. That is perfectly fine for this case. I want to use an existing SDS. The existing SDS is my access control instance. I'm saying next. And accept those things, next, finish. So now it goes and adds all the necessary steps to my project. As that's done, now I need to go in the web config and go and do a I keep forgetting what that setting was. Request validation mode, I believe, is 2.0. Let's hope that's true. And I'm going to go and run it. I said run it. Oh, there it is. It just went hiding. So what happens is I hit 61,000. It already redirects me to access control and says, hey, you have configured the following identity providers. This page is built on a JavaScript JSONP call that you can use yourself. So you can build your own page with your own icons and everything and just have the links come up here. So this is a default page that's just provided for you. And you can actually download that page from the application integration page here. There's login pages, and so for that app, here's the link to the login page, and here's an example page you can go and download. So that's all the integration pieces that are there for you. So I go and going to go pick Google. See, it was the wrong one. It was request validation mode. Let's go and try that again. I probably didn't save. It was exactly what I had to do. Oh. What do you mean it's the location? Oh, yeah, I'm an idiot. Thank you. You all saw that, right? You all saw that, and you let me do it. I will fill out a very negative audience evaluation form. I can tell you that. That's not very nice of you. So I'll do that again. Go to Google. The nice thing is I'm already signed into Google, so it remembered that. So let's go and try to force it. So I'm going to go into IE and run as admin. Oh, sorry, no. That was stupid. I'm going to go into... So here I am there. I'm going to go into that special mode. Who's laughing? What are you surfing with that mode? Go here, go Google. Now it says, hey, you need to go and show your account. So that will then be, now you know all the secrets. And here I am, and I'm Clemens at Google, right? Super straightforward. There was no magic that I just did. And there was no nothing that you can't do. It's really that simple. It's pretty astonishing. So you get the Facebook, you get the Google, you get the you get all these providers, you get Windows Live IDE. This is awesome. This service is free until January 1st, 2012. And then the pricing is going to be, what, $299 per 100,000 calls. So it really is something you should take a very, very, very serious look at. That's the access control service. So lastly, last 5 minutes, and it's 5 minutes mostly because there's I have a little bit to show, but I don't have a lot to show just yet because we're just going to come out with this at TechEd, is how do you deploy your applications, how do you add resources, scale your app, how do you manage the configuration to scale? Wouldn't it be nice if we had a way to go and do hosting in a little more flexible fashion than we have that today in Windows Azure? Go beyond the role model and the VM model and really give us a bunch of components, put a bunch of components into the platform, have the platform know about all the interdependencies, and then have the platform decide where to place the components, where to run them, how to scale them, and deal with all that complexity without you not you having to deal with all that complexity. So for that, we have the host, the container service. I said it's not clear yet exactly what that thing is going to be named like. But these are all these questions. And so we have this application server infrastructure that we're building, which is going to deal with all those things. And you will see that being built out over time in quarterly increments. We're going to add features to that thing. So it's kind of the son of Windows Server App Fabric. Windows Server App Fabric is a way to go and host workflows and services in Windows Server in an efficient manner. We're taking the basic notion of that, more manageability, services for your frameworks, and we're going to extend that out to the cloud and make it really enormously scalable and create high density for you. So I'll show you two pieces here. One is is Visual Studio, I thought. Something's going on. Hello. Where are you? There you are. You're not there. Check that out. It's there, but it's not there. My demo went missing. That is amazing. That's what I get for using VirtualBox. Oh, there it is. So now how do I get it to show? Ah, there we go. All right. Sorry for that glitch. I apologize on behalf of Microsoft Corporation. So what we have here is a view, and you see that is in Visual Studio. This is this application manifest, and I'm showing you this is pre-production software because this is from the previous milestone. It's a visualization of an app. So this is the diagram view. There's a table view, which actually tells you a little bit more, and that has all the components that are in this project. So it's this solution has multiple components, and all these components have also links to each other. So you have a component, and that component has imports and exports. An import is everything that that component consumes, database connections, other web services, queues, etc. Exports is all things that exposes. So a web service endpoint, for instance. You can go for, so you have this benefits info service, and you can see the relationships visualized here. You have the benefits info goes through a queue, through secure connections to benefits management. So that is represented as an import here. And then you have an export here, and you can go and add exports, etc. So the goal of all this, so you're building apps, and instead of having, as we have today, these web references or these services references where you need to go and fix up the config, we're storing that in a model. And that model gets automatically fixed up as the application that gets deployed. So we're doing all that magic and all the configuration on the fly. So you give us this application, which is composed of all those apps. We know the interdependencies between them. And with that, we can move that app between servers to machines because we always know what component is where and what how that component is named, because you give us that data and you do that through that kind of composition. So that is really interesting. What that also leads to is a way for you to go and manage that app. So here is the management surface. And that's just a very quick glimpse here. So there is. And that gives you all my, these are all my deployed apps, right? And it gives you an insight into those apps. So this is the benefits app where that sits, right? And so we have now enough information about the application to see all the pieces, to show you all the pieces, and then have individual information about all those pieces in here. And I don't have, and you have logging and what happens. So we're going to give you insight into all those things. This is a mock-up right now of the Servalite service as we're developing it. More importantly, there's going to be an OData feed of all the monitoring data and OData API, how you can go and extract all that information out. And over time, that capability will grow in a way that you'll be able to go and even do deep inspection into all your components. So you run a queue, you'll get to traffic statistics on that queue. You have a service bus connection point. You'll be able to go into in there and see all the current sessions. You have a component that's running, and you'll see how many instances that that has and how many calls it's getting, et cetera, et cetera. So you're going to get all that through the management API over time. So, again, more data on that will be available as we get to PDC. So roadmap, we have already shipped the CTP refresh for the access control and for caching in the first quarter of this year. Now access control has shipped. Caching is shipping today. Then CTP service bus refresh is coming out in a few weeks. And also the composite app, they're going to be, I believe, a little bit later with their CTP. That's this hosting story that I'm just talking about. And then we're trying to make this all available, certainly for service bus, the new features, by the end of this year or during this year, and then the comp app service, the composite app, the hosting service, that will stay in CTP throughout the year and then ship sometime in 2012. That's what I had, kind of give you an overview of the App Fabric roadmap. Tomorrow, 10:50, I go deep on service bus, show you more of the capabilities. With that, remember, it's the new middle tier infrastructure for Windows Azure, also piece is very useful, especially access control, service bus, for apps that are not necessarily running in Windows Azure, even your own websites. So it's worth looking at for all kinds of scenarios. And with that, if you have questions, I'll be over at the Azure booth, and I'll be here all night. Or you can even tweet me, and I'll try to answer there. Thanks for coming.